It's the next building boom. Pipeline projects crisscrossing our region so natural gas can get to market. One rural community is struggling to keep up with all the construction.
We get calls all the time, and they're increasing, and it's for somebody's cutting these trees down, and somebody's doing something in this creek, and we don't know what's going on.
I'm Carol Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, as one community shifts from a coal economy to natural gas, a coal miner just a few dozen miles away wonders if he'll be laid off again.
Kind of thinking it might happen again, but we'll see when it happens.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. The number of state and federal lawsuits related to climate change has been on the rise since 2006. Rebecca Williams reports that experts say we're likely to see a lot more.
A recent study in the journal Science finds the role of climate science in court is changing. Sabrina McCormick is the study's lead author. She's an associate professor of environmental and occupational health at the George Washington University. McCormick and her team looked at more than 870 judicial decisions between 1990 and 2016. They found that climate science is being used more often in lawsuits, starting about 10 years ago.
For example, the historic case of Massachusetts versus EPA, which was in 2007, which led to the regulation of greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act, as well as other key cases.
McCormick says of the cases the team looked at, more cases were won by anti-regulation plaintiffs than those advocating for more regulations. Think lawsuits over coal-burning power plants.
When you look at air cases, for example, you see people who are interested in kind of anti-regulatory outcomes winning more than the other type of plaintiff.
So she says people who want fewer regulations tend to win suits more often. Except when it comes to cases over renewable energy and energy efficiency. Those kinds of lawsuits have been coming up more recently, and McCormick says you see something very different happening there.
Which is you see that folks who are interested in the advancement or the proliferation of renewable energy winning more those who are interested in the advancement of fossil fuels. So the trends around who's winning and losing really depend on what kind of case it is.
McCormick says a winning case can have profound effects on everything from local communities to federal policies. She says, not surprisingly, California has significantly more climate lawsuits than any other state.
And when cases are won in that state, that state can set precedents for other states who want to adopt the policy that's been advanced in the court system in California.
So she says it can have a huge ripple effect across the country. For example, California's tighter fuel economy standards for cars were upheld when Vermont wanted to adopt the same standards. McCormick says it's likely we'll see more lawsuits during the Trump administration. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Rebecca Williams.
One climate-related regulation that was being tied up in the court system is no longer at issue.
I'll be signing a proposed rule to withdraw the so-called Clean Power Plan of the past administration and thus begin the effort to withdraw that rule.
This week, Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Scott Pruitt announced the undoing of the Obama-era rule to address greenhouse gas emissions. The Clean Power Plan never actually took effect, because more than two dozen states sued, led by then Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt, arguing the EPA overstepped its legal authority. The Supreme Court had been looking into those claims. On this week's Trump on Earth podcast, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier spoke with someone who agrees with Pruitt's outlook, Jeff Homestead. He was a former White House staffer for President George H.W. Bush and appointed Assistant Administrator for Air at EPA under George W. Bush. He's currently head of the Environmental Strategies Group at Bracewell LLP, an international law firm. Here's some of their conversation.
I think a lot of people have if you know about the Clean Power Plan at all, you know that it's aimed at reducing CO2 emissions from the electric sector, which is kind of our largest source of CO2 in this country. You've said before you believe the Clean Power Plan was federal overreach. I want to see if you could just walk us through your argument about why you think that is.
I think there's kind of a misperception that a lot of people have that EPA's job is to come up with regulations to address these issues. And so people say to me, well, the Supreme Court said that EPA has authority under the Clean Air Act to regulate greenhouse gas emissions, and therefore that's why they did what they did. That's only partly true. What the Supreme Court said was not that EPA could go out and come up with whatever system it thought best. It said, well, you have to use the particular statutory programs that were designed by Congress and put in the Clean Air Act. Those are the only tools you have to deal with climate change. You can't come up with other ones just because you think they're better or more effective. With the Clean Power Plan, EPA tried to do several things that went way beyond what EPA had ever done before and really flew in the face not only of the statutory language but of 45 years of history. And so this provision that they've used actually was adopted back in 1970. And it was designed to, and what it allows EPA to do, is to decide what kinds of technology controls or operational methods can be used to reduce emissions at a particular plant when that plant is operating. So it's basically designed to make sure that individual plants are well controlled. And over the years, EPA has done more than 100 of these standards, and sometimes they update them. So, for example, coal-fired power plants, those requirements have been updated for different pollutants over the years, but always what they do, they say, what is the best way of controlling emissions when this plant is operating? The Obama administration had a different idea as to how they wanted to do this, and instead of trying to reduce the emissions rate to control emissions of individual plants, they came up with a very complicated scheme that was designed, in essence, to take electricity generation away from coal-fired power plants and just transfer that over to renewable wind and solar plants. And they had a lot of policy reasons for doing that, but the big problem is the statute doesn't give them that authority. What they tried to do just goes well beyond what Congress allowed and what Congress intended or what's allowed under the Clean Air Act.
The power sector is a large source of greenhouse gas emissions from the United States. If the Clean Air Act is not the right vehicle for the federal government to step in and say, we're going to cut carbon emissions across the board and for the electric sector, this is what we're going to do for you, how would you, if you were the in charge of things, how would you deal with climate change, with carbon emissions from the electricity sector?
Legally, the only way to do that is to have Congress adopt new legislation. So for the last 250 years of our history, we've had this constitutional system that says Congress adopts the laws, and it's the role of the executive branch, the administration, to implement or to enforce those laws. And essentially what had happened in the Obama administration is they were frustrated with Congress and said, well, we're going to come up with our own system, and we're going to be, you know, very creative in trying to use the Clean Air Act. From a practical perspective, it's much harder than people want to acknowledge. The reason we have greenhouse gas emissions, not only in the United States but around the world, is the use of fossil fuels has dramatically changed the way that we live. And the reason why carbon dioxide emissions continue to go up is because by far the least expensive way to provide electricity in most of the world, you know, the United States is kind of an exception now because of the low-cost natural gas that we have, but in virtually all of the world, the least expensive way to produce electricity is to burn coal. And it's the case in the United States and everywhere else that the use of oil is the least expensive way to provide transportation. So until we figure out other methods, other ways of providing electricity or fueling our transportation sector, we're not going to solve the problem. And I get frustrated with people who say what we need are new laws or regulations. That's not going to solve the problem. Regulations are not going to solve the problem because this is a worldwide problem, and there are still roughly a billion people in the world that don't have any electricity. And the leaders of those countries, until they have a cost-effective way to provide electricity to those people, that that gives affordable, reliable electricity that at least is competitive with coal, we're not going to solve the problem. So I think personally we need to invest much more in the way we've solved many other problems, and that is with technological breakthroughs that could really make a fundamental difference. So ultimately, if you ask me how we can possibly do it, I think we need to make sure that we're investing in the kind of basic research that could provide that technology.
Jeff Homestead spoke with the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier for our Trump on Earth podcast. His argument that climate change is a problem for technology, not regulation, is sort of standard among some Republicans. But there's a lot more of the conversation at TrumpOnEarth.org, and some of it's pretty surprising. Jeff Homestead worked on environmental policy in previous Republican administrations, and he's now head of the Environmental Strategies Group at Bracewell LLP. Trump on Earth is a co-production with Point Park University's Environmental Journalism Program. That's TrumpOnEarth.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. In Appalachia, coal jobs are becoming few and far between. So the miners who have work are trying to hold on to it, even though the future is uncertain.
I don't know if I'd want to do anything else. I mean, I tried. No one would hire me.
Coming up later on the Allegheny Front, reporting from the front lines of the struggle to stay and work in coal country. This next story brings all the talking points and theories about regulation and energy production down to the local level, to the real people. Bordering western Pennsylvania, the landscape of eastern Ohio is changing. Stretches of hillsides are being cleared of trees to make way for well pads and pipelines. The oil and gas industry is starting to take a front seat in what's traditionally been a rural coal community. And much like Pennsylvania, some people are excited about the new industry. But the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant found that others are concerned there's not enough regulation in place to protect waterways.
Big mounds of waste from two Murray Energy coal mines used to sit along the banks of Captina Creek in Belmont County, Ohio. People call them gob piles.
I played on those gob piles as a kid.
This is Mark Thomas. He's now president of the county commission here.
It's the waste from the coal that they started dumping, and they started dumping and dumping, and the next thing you know, you have a hill.
This is around where Ohio, Pennsylvania, and West Virginia all meet. It's part of the Appalachian Coal Basin, one of the largest coal fields in the country. Belmont County itself is home to one of the nation's well-known coal barons, Robert Murray. By the late 1970s, his companies had left the water quality in Captina Creek so bad, large sections of it were declared dead. Local citizens mounted an effort to clean it up, and the coal companies helped. They removed those gob piles from the banks of the creek. Today, Captina is considered one of the cleanest streams in Ohio. People swim and fish in it. Abby Hayward is the Captina Creek Watershed Coordinator at the Belmont County Soil and Water Conservation District. She keeps an eye on the rare and endangered species here, like the eastern hellbender salamander.
That species in particular is sensitive to clear water. They need clearer water because they breathe through their skin.
Hayward moved to this area late last year to keep watch over the creek. She didn't really know anything about mining. She just started and couldn't believe her luck. Area residents, environmental groups, and coal companies were all meeting about the creek.
And for someone on my second day at my job, that was impressive to me because I was like, they do work together and this is going to be great. I have people helping.
But Hayward quickly noticed something odd on the landscape.
I'm driving and I see this thing and I slowed down and it was a rig lit up at night.
It took her a minute to realize this was a well pad where companies frack for natural gas.
I was like, oh, they do have that here, don't they?
On many hillsides here, the trees are all torn out and the land is cleared. No one in her office had mentioned fracking, neither did the recently completed watershed action plan. And then last spring, Hayward started getting flooded with phone calls. There was a pipeline boom.
Yeah, we get calls all the time. And they're increasing, and it's for the somebody's cutting these trees down, and somebody's doing something in this creek, and we don't know what's going on.
Energy companies need pipelines to connect their frack wells with the wider energy distribution system. But they aren't necessarily informing local offices like Hayward's about what they're doing.
Some people are very understanding because they've been calling 15 different offices trying to get an answer. Some landowners who are very upset because they have somebody doing work in their back 40 and it is encroaching on their water supply.
Hayward tries to track things down, but this isn't like the hometown coal company, where the people who work there also live in the community. With pipelines, there are so many different companies from all over, Oklahoma, Texas, Alberta, Canada.
You don't get a lot of feedback, and you try to contact the right person, and there's just so many people, and they move so fast because they have deadlines, and trying to find, do I talk to the environmental representative? Do I talk to a landman? Do I talk to, I don't know who to go to.
And what if there's a problem? Hayward points to spills by the Rover Pipeline, a 700-mile natural gas transmission line being built from West Virginia through Ohio and into Michigan. Rover has already been cited by Ohio regulators 13 times, and it spilled more than 2 million gallons of diesel-laced drilling mud into a pristine Ohio wetland near a municipal water supply. This is the sound of workers walking through the 13-inch thick gray-colored muck it left behind. It's from a video provided by the Ohio EPA. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission actually stepped in to halt Rover's construction over the summer at Captina Creek and elsewhere.
I don't worry about the big transmission lines like the Rover and spills like that, because those get reported quite a bit of the time and they get a lot of media coverage. What I worry about are these gathering lines.
This is Ted Auk. He collects data about the oil and gas industry in Ohio for a nonprofit called Frack Tracker. He says the smaller gathering pipelines that connect well pads to the larger gas distribution system are a bigger concern.
And those lines going through these streams and up and down slopes, and how little we know about them. They're the known unknown of the pipeline industry.
And this region has a lot of them. Ohio and Pennsylvania are among the states with the most local gathering lines in the U.S. According to a report from the American Petroleum Institute, there are more than 24,000 miles of these lines in Ohio alone.
When you contact people in those counties, they say, yeah, we know that the pipeline goes across County Road 15 or whatever, and then it goes across State Road 40. But in between there, we have no idea what it's doing. Well, that's a huge That's 95% of the pipeline.
Pipelines over a certain size do need to be certified by the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio. And if a pipeline builder plans to cross a creek or other waterway and uses a method that will impact the water, it also needs a state certification. But when it comes to siting those smaller gathering lines, the state says local zoning authorities are in charge. But are they?
The county has really no teeth as far as regulations.
That's Belmont County Commission President Mark Thomas. He's the one we heard from who used to play on coal gobs.
Are these industries regulated as was coal? Is it safer? What's it going to do to the environment? The best that we can do is look to the state.
But as the coal economy fades, Thomas weighs those risks with the benefits. He's convinced the oil and gas industry will help this region reinvent itself after coal long term. A chemical company based in Thailand has purchased property in Belmont County along the Ohio River. It's expected to announce by the end of the year if it will build a multi-billion dollar ethane cracker, similar to the Shell plant under construction in Beaver County, Pennsylvania, that'll use the natural gas from fracking to create the building blocks of plastic and make natural gas the next job creator in this region. Abby Hayward has no intention of trying to stop this, but when she sees pipeline construction equipment sitting right in Captina Creek, she wants to know what's going on. But she doesn't have any authority and is wary of making waves.
They have tight deadlines, and somebody's paying them a lot of money, and they're paying a lot of people, and I'm just somebody who's trying to keep a creek nice.
For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
In the coming weeks, we'll take a deeper dive into pipeline construction and what's in place to protect waterways from this fast-moving industry.
The velocity and the intensity of the landscape change and activities tells me that they're out ahead of their skis. It just has to be.
More on the pipeline boom in the coming weeks on the Allegheny Front. What about communities where the coal industry is still chugging along and people are dependent on those dwindling jobs? That's 38-year-old Dave Hathaway's story. After being unemployed for a year, Dave is working at a new coal mine, the Cumberland Mine, in Greene County, Pennsylvania. He didn't want to go back underground, but no other job came close to paying him enough to support his family and to continue to live in his hometown. You might remember his story from our show a few weeks back. It was part of a series from West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Inside Appalachia podcast called Struggle to Stay. So how's it going for Dave Hathaway now? Here's the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier.
I visited Dave about a month after he started back at the mine. He dropped the 20 pounds he put on during his year of unemployment and had shaved off his beard, which had gotten pretty wild by the end of the year. Was it hard, I asked, getting back into the swing of things?
It wasn't. I mean, you close your eyes and open them, you could think you're at the Emerald. I mean, other than the guys, you know what I mean? I mean, my whole crew's all young guys, like 25, I think 24, 20, 27. It's like the oldest guy on my crew.
At Emerald, Dave had pretty high seniority. He was operating equipment above ground. Generally, the further away from the place they're mining the coal, the better. Whatever seniority Dave had at Emerald went away when the mine shut down. At his new mine, Dave was back at the bottom of the totem pole, even beneath the 20-year-olds he was working next to. He was working the section, the active part of the mine where they cut into new rock with a huge machine called a continuous miner. He handled advancing the mine's ventilation system at the face of the coal seam.
I mean, all I do is pretty much I stand up at the miner all day, 8 hours. Well, 9.5 hours. It gets pretty boring. Same thing every goddamn day.
Dave said it was hard to adjust, not just to the physically demanding parts of the job, but the hours.
Them first 2 weeks were ridiculous, man. I was beat.
Every week, he has to work a different shift. 1 week on daylight, another on afternoons, and another midnight.
Yeah, midnight. That was the first midnight shift I've worked in over a year. That was pretty brutal.
Dave was sitting at his kitchen table. It's one of those high tables you sit at with tall chairs. He walked across the kitchen to blow his nose. The Kleenex was black. He and Ashley want to move, not out of Greene County, just a little outside of city limits. They live in town and want a house with some land on it. Coal mining is the best way he can afford to do this. But in the back of his mind, he's still wondering, how long will this last? For years, coal mines have been getting more coal out of the ground with fewer and fewer workers, and the country is simply using less of it than it used to. In 2015, Pennsylvania's coal mines produced the lowest amount of coal in the state since 1894. Dave wonders, what happens when the longwall machine finishes the section of coal they're currently mining?
And, I mean, they're so short, too. Like, the longwall just, it's going to rip through them.
He's saying that maybe there's just not much coal left to mine, and maybe he'll get laid off when the machines reach the end of the coal seam.
Kind of thinking it might happen again, like, because, I mean, I don't know, but we'll see when it happens. Ride it out again.
He says he'll probably be underground the rest of his time at Cumberland.
Yeah, I'll be underground probably the rest of my career there. Which, I mean, I'm not mad about it, but it does suck.
I ask him, what would he do if he could do anything else?
I don't think I could do anything else now.
Really? You could do stuff.
I could, yeah. I mean, it'd probably be, I don't know. Yeah, it's probably where I have to be. I don't know if I'd want to do anything else. I mean, I tried. No one would hire me. So, yeah. I mean, everyone else thinks I'm just a stupid coal miner too, I guess.
Dave has a pointed sense of humor. It's kind of like a coping mechanism, a way of saying, ah, screw it. He often jokes with Ashley that someday he'll move into a van and just live there. He says it so often, it's hard to tell whether he's joking or not. Ashley brings Deacon into the kitchen and sits the baby on Dave's lap while she washes up some dishes.
What'd you do with Grandma today?
Huh? Deacon is now 5 months old, and he's up to 20 pounds. The baby stares at my microphone and tries to touch it. It's got a fake fur windscreen that probably looks like a stuffed animal to Deacon.
Yeah. Hey, Daddy making that coal miner money now. You haven't seen that.
I ask whether they'd ever want to leave Greene County. Dave pauses, like it's a question he'd never spent too much time thinking about.
Yeah, well, I don't think we'll move out of Greene County. We're stuck here. We're lifers.
Would you ever want to leave Greene County?
I don't know.
Dave says maybe once Deacon is in college, that maybe then they'll try and find somewhere else to live. Dave's son, Grant, is one of the big reasons why he doesn't want to leave. In a previous story, I've told you about Grant's wrestling match that Dave took me to, how he lost to a bigger, stronger, better wrestler. Well, Grant had another match that night. It would determine whether he moved on to the next round in his school's wrestling playoffs. He paced the floor of the gym while he waited for his turn to come up. Grant and another boy square off.
Get off your knees, Grant!
They're well matched, and neither of them can gain much of an advantage. Dave is in his seat just staring at Grant, who manages to go up by a point. Finally, the match ends. Grant ekes out a win. I give Grant a high five.
Good job, Grant. Excellent. So how'd he do? That was really good.
Yeah, that was good.
Did he win?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, 1-0. When he come out of bounds, that was an escape. He got one.
Ashley is there, carrying Deacon in on a car seat. So are Dave's father and stepmother. Dave roves around the gym, chatting with other dads and wrestling coaches. He knows a lot of the people in this room. Grant is beaming. The dejection he felt from losing that first match is gone, almost like it had never happened. He has a medal around his shoulders, which he keeps touching. That match was in March. In April, Dave suffered an injury when a rock fell from the ceiling inside the mine and hit his knee. He was on workers' compensation for months while his knee healed. He had to have surgery for his meniscus, and the knee still hurts, adding to the various injuries he's suffered over the years, including an ache in his lower back from a previous coal mining accident. I visited Dave a few weeks ago at his house. He told me if he had gotten a different job when he was laid off, he wouldn't have gone back to coal mining. But that was kind of a moot point right now. He had a job at the mine. He had a paycheck. He had insurance for his family. And that night, he'd be headed back to work to take the midnight shift. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
You can read more about Dave Hathaway's struggle to stay at AlleghenyFront.org. West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Inside Appalachia follows six people as they decide whether to stay or go in the Struggle to Stay series. You can listen at Inside Appalachia Podcast or visit wvpublic.org. Thanks for listening to this week's Allegheny Front. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, at Allegheny Front. And of course, there's our Trump on Earth podcast, trumponearth.org. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation.